solution that was looked for and searched for back in the 1960s, based on their demands that were representative of the countryside, of the demands of the people in the countryside, the peasantry, there wouldn't be a FARC. Now, some people could say that's historical revisionism, that obviously so many things have happened over those 52 years. But what happened was that the United States, under the Johnson administration, insisted on a military solution to the uprising that was taking place in the countryside in Colombia at that time, fear of another Cuba in South America. And obviously that was the approach. And then that was in the 1960s. In the 1980s, which was just referred to in terms of how the peace process at that time was trying to politically insert the FARC through the Patriotic Union into the landscape of electoral politics and political participation, the response was a military response, massacring 3,000 to 4,000 militants of the UP, and it was with the support of the Reagan administration and the CIA and military involvement then. And this is something that Daniel Garcia Peña is very clear about. In the 1990s, late 90s and early 80s, which he initiated in part of those last negotiations, the attempt was, when they were just about to negotiate and begin a process of peace back then, the response was Plan Colombia, militarization, strengthening the armed forces. And now people are, you know, historically looking at it and saying, well, the U.S., if it wasn't for the U.S. support, we wouldn't have gotten to this point. But the bottom line is 15 years have passed since those previous negotiations. Tens of thousands of people have been killed, millions displaced. And so we have to say, what has been the result of those last 15 years of war that might have been resolved had they looked at other options?
We're going to continue this conversation, post online at democracynow.org. Daniel Garcia Peña, thanks so much for being with us from Bogota, Colombia, Colombia's former High Commissioner for Peace, and as well, Mario Murillo. Thanks so much for being with us. That does it for our broadcast. We have two job openings. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. The U.S. Supreme Court today upheld the affirmative action program at the University of Texas. The vote was 4-3. Only 7 justices participated in the decision. Justice Elena Kagan had recused herself because she had worked on the case when she was a U.S. Solicitor General. Also, the Supreme Court deadlocked 4-4 today over the legality of President Obama's sweeping immigration plan, dealing a defeat to the White House. The tie vote leaves in place lower court orders from Texas that have blocked Obama's plan to suspend deportation and offer work permits to about 4 million parents who have been living illegally in the United States. Do you own a business? Have you considered promoting your work to Portland's most progressive audience? Of course, you know that KBOO is fiercely non-commercial and always will be, but we do look for local business partners to help sponsor or underwrite our programs. Underwriters receive acknowledgments during the shows they underwrite, which lets listeners know who you are, what you do, and how to reach you. Everybody wins. Your business becomes aligned with KBOO's values of peace, justice, and multiculturalism, and KBOO is able to continue providing access, training, and programming for the entire community. To learn more about KBOO underwriting and to see a complete list of our sponsors, go to kboo.fm/underwriting or call Justin at 503-231-8032. Your clients are listening. Coming up next is Voices from the Edge Talk Radio with our host, Joanne Hardesty. Today, we'll talk about the Supreme Court, who just decided that police can use evidence found during an illegal stop to prosecute citizens. We'll talk about that and other issues related to our move towards a police state.
KBOO is getting ready for our annual book and record sale. Yay! This is a great time to clean out those closets and shelves and turn your old books, records, and CDs into cash for community radio. Bring them to KBOO Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. We're accepting donations of books, vinyl records, CDs, and DVDs through Wednesday, August 10th. The sale will be held in mid-August. Stay tuned for details. Please, no home recorded cassettes, VHS tapes, or mold. If you have questions or want to arrange for a pickup of donations, please email Ani at volunteer@kboo.org or phone her at 503-231-8032, extension 213.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to be a founding sponsor of the Waterfront Blues Festival, the hallmark event for the Oregon Food Bank. This year, the festival will be held July 1st through 4th at Tom McCall Waterfront Park. Everyone will need a pass this year to see such artists as Dr. John and the Night Trippers, Liv Warfield and the Special Horns, Curtis Salgado, and many more. More information about passes, the performers, the role of the Oregon Food Bank, and more can be found at kboo.fm/WBF2016.
Good people, stay tuned every second and fourth Thursday at 8 p.m. for Guess Who's Coming to Radio, a show with music and discussion, addressing socio-political issues relevant to African peoples in this nation. We encourage you to call in with some positive, proactive solutions to what we are facing today. Guess Who's Coming to Radio, every second and fourth Thursday at 8 p.m. on KBOO, your community radio.
Good morning, good morning. Welcome to Voices from the Edge. And of course, I'm your host, Joanne Hardesty. I want to apologize for not having Bobin Singh from the Oregon Justice Resource Center on today to talk about the report, The Color of Justice. However, I am working on getting him and his Washington, D.C. colleague on for our show next week or the week after, but soon. The report just came out yesterday, so I think I was too quick for the people who could tell you more about that report. Again, won't be any surprises in the report, but information we must have. I want to spend some time talking about a couple of recent activities or decisions. The first, you may have heard that on Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court came down with a decision on a case regarding Utah versus Strofe. And the case was about an illegal traffic stop that was conducted based on an anonymous tip. And when the police, an anonymous tip that this person was transporting drugs on the highway. And so after the stop and search, the person was found to have had drug paraphernalia, no drugs on them. And the case went all the way to the Utah Supreme Court, which had ruled that the evidence could not be used to prosecute this gentleman because the evidence was obtained illegally by the police. The district attorney appealed that ruling, and the U.S. Supreme Court has just ruled that basically that was fine. It matters who serves on the Supreme Court because I want to take a moment and just read shortly a piece from Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who broke with the majority in this case about unreasonable search and seizures, citing James Baldwin and Tanisha Coates and her dissent. And so the court ruled in a 5-3 decision. The court reversed the Utah Supreme Court decision that the illegal stop disqualified the evidence. Instead, the Supreme Court ruled that the evidence did not violate the Fourth Amendment because the evidence seized weakened the unlawful stop. So basically, the stop should not have happened, but since the stop happened and the police officer found something, it should be okay to use what they found, even though they had no right to stop the individual. And no surprise, Justice Clarence Thomas, in writing for the majority, stated that the requirement that if the evidence was thrown out, basically, that would remove the deterrent impact of this person being prosecuted by unlawful police actions. You can't make this stuff up. These are the people that currently serve on the U.S. Supreme Court. And as you know, Clarence Thomas has not been a champion of civil rights of any kind in his time on the court. What's remarkable about our current justice, Sonia Sotomayor, is that she related this case not just to history, which in itself should cause concern, but also to the most recent book by Tanisha Coates, which was his book, A Letter to His Son. If you'd like to join the conversation, give me a call. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. And so when she quoted this book in her dissent, here's what she said. I'm sorry, my computer is a bit slow this morning. It keeps dying on me for some reason. Here's what she said. The central point in Sotomayor's dissent is that the case centers around suspicionless stops that are all too familiar for people of color. Even though the defendant in this case is white, she cites James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time, W.E.B. Du Bois' The Souls of Black Folks, and Tanisha Coates' Between the World and Me as evidence of those who have testified to what it is like with the and what it is like living with the indignity of always being susceptible to unconstitutional searches, especially when one has done nothing more than be born in a body that is always already deemed criminal. What a powerful, powerful statement from Supreme Court Justice Sotomayor. She gets it. She gets that giving police more power to illegally target the people that they currently target just means that more people of color will be impacted by police violence. And so how that will play out is anybody's guess. You know, we still have one seat vacant on the U.S. Supreme Court because we have a Congress who has failed to act to replace the member who died on the U.S. Supreme Court. And so I guess the anticipation is waiting until the next president takes office, which is a bit scary to think about who could get through a confirmation process during that time. And speaking of crazy policing policies, I don't know if you've been following what's been happening with Oakland, California, but they have lost 3 police chiefs in 9 days due to sex scandals within the Portland police, within the Oakland Police Bureau. 3 police chiefs in 9 days. And so we are bad, but so far we're not that bad. You want to join the conversation? Give me a call at 503-231-8187. And I am so thankful that Judge Sonia Sotomayor is on the U.S. Supreme Court, a voice of reason, a voice of logic, a voice of lived experiences. And so for people who say it really doesn't matter who's on the Supreme Court, it really, 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 really does. That is clear over and over and over again. It's also clear that the next president and the next Congress, and hopefully it's a different Congress than the one that we currently have. And let's talk about what's been happening in Congress over the last, I guess it's about 18 hours, almost 24 hours now, which is House members have taken over the House chambers and declared a sit-in and have stated that they will not leave until they have the opportunity to vote on gun safety legislation. There's a piece of legislation in particular that I find disturbing that that Democrats are actually rallying around as good public policy. And what always happens after a mass shooting is that, you know, we come up with these simplistic solutions to complex problems. What's in front of the U.S. Congress right now, as far as legislation goes, would ban people who are on the no-fly list from being able to purchase a firearm. But you may remember that the no-fly list is a secret list of individuals that really don't know how they get on the list, and they don't know how they get off the list. And if you're on the list, the only way to know you're on the list is if you actually try to board a plane in an airport in the United States of America. And so I'm not sure. I mean, I appreciate being in the minority party and being able to use tactics and strategies to highlight the lack of progress on really fundamental issues. However, I would not have chosen to do a sit-in at the U.S. Congress around such weak gun legislation and, quite frankly, such legislation that's not really thoughtful. I mean, the big thing that should be a given is that we should ban assault rifles from individual ownership. I mean, that should be just a given. Anything else is a much more detailed, thoughtful conversation and interaction. Background checks before guns are not would make sense. So those are two like really basic. You don't need a whole lot of conversation around legislation that should be no brainers. But we have the NRA controlling a part of Congress, a big part of Congress, that absolutely doesn't want to talk about a ban on assault weapons. And so guess what? That doesn't even make it into consideration. Instead, what we have is a list that we know is racially biased. We know that people with Muslims are going to be much more likely to be on the list. We know people with foreign-sounding names are much more likely to be on the list. And so basically what the House Democrats are advocating for is that we allow the secret no-fly list to be used as the vehicle to determine who's worthy and who's not worthy of walking around with a gun. You want to join the conversation? Give me a call, 503-231-8187. That way, there's a conversation and I'm not just talking to you. It would be great to hear your thoughts. What do you think on the Supreme Court's decision? How's that going to play out on illegal police stops? I mean, already we have too many illegal police stops. And so telling police that it's okay if the stop's illegal, if you find something, then we'll make it okay. It will become legal once you find something. I think that that just opens up a new can of worms at a time that we're smack dab in the middle of a Department of Justice investigation, at a time that we're smack dab in the middle of having our entire command of Portland Police Bureau being investigated because of the actions of the police chief, at a time where the Human Rights Commission, the Community Oversight Advisory Board, the Community Police Advisory Committee, none of those bodies are meeting or functional. And so we in Portland have our own severe problems around police accountability and oversight and management, and it's getting worse rather than better. And so it is my hope that that the current police commissioner will not, behind closed doors, negotiate a contract with Portland Police Association prior to the new police commissioner being able to come in and negotiate the contract. I have to ask the question, what is the rush? The contract expires a year from now. So there's absolutely no reason for the current police commissioner to be negotiating behind closed doors with the police union. The other thing is that the community was promised that any policies around body-worn cameras would be developed in public and approved by the city council. And so I have to ask, how can Mayor Hales be negotiating body cam legislation behind closed doors when the city council has not adopted a policy that would be appropriate. And the last thing the public wants is police officers reviewing camera data before they write a written report. If a police officer is honest, they will write the report based on what they saw, witnessed, or participated in. They don't need a video to remind them of what the circumstances in the case were. And so I'm very, very concerned in light of the Supreme Court ruling, in light of the behind-closed-door negotiations on a new contract that the current mayor doesn't even have to look at, doesn't even have to touch, that we will end up in a policing state much more severe than the one that we're currently in, and that we could thank the outgoing mayor for making that impossible to change for the life of the new contract. That would be a very bad outcome for the people in Portland and for the people who've been working on police accountability. I'm going to go to the phone line. Good morning, David. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning. You've raised so many good issues in the last 5 minutes.
Well, thank you.
I wanted to speak particularly to what's going on the floor of Congress right now. Mm. And I agree with you, and I thank you for articulating that the Democrats in Congress are going to a protest action over a really bad issue. I heard a clip from John Lewis's speech where he was recommending this, and what I liked about it was he was saying that Congress has done nothing on the gun control issue, and he asked the question, where is the heart of this body? Where is the soul of this body? Hmm. I think that's a huge issue, mm-hmm. and I love the fact that some members of Congress are finally sitting down there and saying, this body is not doing its job, but it's so unfortunate that they're squandering it on such a violation of civil rights. You know, that no-fly list is terrible, and it's secret, as you pointed out, and it's biased. It's just the worst thing. So my question is, are we wasting this opportunity? Are we going to be unable to insist on this moral imperative in the future because we've squandered the action on an issue that didn't deserve it? How are the Democrats in Congress going to call for responsibility on the part of Congress if they blow it on this one? Yes. Are they then going to be unable to do it on any other issues? Is this it? Have they blown the opportunity now?
Well, I hope not, but it looks...
I'll take my answer offline. I'll hang up.
Thank you for your call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
I hope not. I hope they haven't squandered the opportunity to do something significant. But from where I sit, from what I read, from what I have listened to and watched on as part of the news coverage, it's clear that this legislation is not legislation that the American people want. What the American people want is for average people not to be able to walk into a gun shop and buy a semi-automatic weapon. What is the purpose of a semi-automatic weapon? Hunters don't use semi-automatic weapons. The only people that use semi-automatic weapons are people with an intent to kill a lot of people in a short period of time. And so it doesn't seem like it's rocket science, but it kind of feels that way because our Congress has been so inept at actually coming up with good legislation and then actually supporting it. And I hope that this sit-in doesn't come across as just a publicity stunt, because quite frankly, at the end of the day, if there's a vote on this legislation, there are many people who would be negatively impacted because they're already targeted for enhanced security by police and TSA and Homeland Security and all the other policing agencies that are watching and impacting our life. And so we're going to go back to the phone line. Hello, Camilo. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Thank you. Thank you for another terrific program. Perhaps this program may not be the ideal vehicle, but perhaps you could do another program, and I would love to hear you discuss the whole background of the COAB problem and what can we do to change things. I had intended to get involved with it, but now that it's been disrupted, I doubt that that would be worthwhile.
Yeah, well, actually, they are looking for a COAB chair. There is a job application out. And again, here's a great example of not telling the public the truth. So Kathleen Sadat's position is being announced now, and they're calling it a 20-hour-a-week position. Knowing what you know, just based on a peripheral view, I can assure you that that is not a 20-hour-a-week position, and no one that's had it prior to has worked less than 60 to 80 hours a week. And so the fact that they're advertising it as a 20-hour-a-week position, and again, the contractor is from Chicago, and so it's at a length that you're recruiting the new person. Who in their right mind would sign up for this job and that they say is 20 hours a week, but all the people who've done it have worked 60 to 80 hours a week? And so that's one thing. The second thing is they have tried to wring the community out of the Community Oversight Advisory Board. What did they think would happen when you start telling the community they can't talk, they've got to stand in a free speech zone, they can't videotape? This is our community. We live here, right? So they took the community out of the Community Oversight Advisory Board, or they tried to, and so the community pushed back. What's going to happen? I mean, with the disarray of our police department currently, with the mayor behind closed doors negotiating a new contract that's not necessary for him to do because the contract doesn't expire for a full year, and the new police commissioner should be the one negotiating that contract. So he's busy doing stuff he shouldn't be doing when he should be fixing what's broken within the Portland Police Bureau, figuring out who the interim police chief is going to be over the next year, because the new police commissioner will actually appoint the new police chief. And so, but we need some certainty. The current interim chair is also under investigation, like all the other assistant chiefs. And so we appear to be in this downward spiral with no leadership. And let me say, I don't know where the DOJ is. Department of Justice talked a big game when they came to town, but they've been silent while all this has been happening. And so what was your question? How do we get it back on track?
It seems like it's a mess, and I want to do something positive, but I'm totally discouraged by everything you just said.
Well, here's what I think would be good to do. I think the entire city council is responsible for this implosion, and the entire city council is responsible for providing leadership to fix it. And so I think at a minimum, people should be calling and or writing or emailing the entire city council to say, what are you doing to fix this, right? This is we're at a critical stage in police accountability, and all our systems are imploding, and the mayor's busy negotiating a contract that he doesn't have to live under. Meanwhile, the rest of the city council is totally silent. And so the first thing I would do is call them and say, well, what are you doing to fix the COAB? What's your role?
Well, would you consider having a program devoted to working on this idea and getting people involved?
Well, you know, I mean, at the sake of full disclosure, I'm considering applying for the COAB, but I'm also considering applying in partnership with someone from the mental health community, because I think we know what should happen. The question is whether or not the powers that be want the process to be successful. I keep thinking that they keep setting people up for failure. When you have very grassroots people, we've burned out six people in the last 2 years primarily because we have volunteers we're expecting to work 40 hours a week, but yet the paid staff is expected to work 40 to 60 hours a week.
Well, I'll stay in touch with you about this. I'm a retired mental health professional, and if there's anything that I can do to support you, I'd be delighted.
Well, thank you. I just think that the community's got to take back the Community Oversight Advisory Board. We had a vision for the community actually driving reform, and what the city has allowed to happen is to institutionalize a process that is supposedly community-driven. And so maybe they'll want the community in charge, maybe not. But, yes, stay in touch, and I'll let you know how it plays out.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good day. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Good morning, Aaron. Welcome to KBOO. Hello, Aaron.
Hey, good morning. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
We're hitting on a lot of topics today. I wanted to first discuss the affirmative action and the way that came down with Ms. Abigail Fisher. Ms. Abigail Fisher, the young lady that has been fighting this, was not qualified to get into a University of Texas school. So I always found it somewhat funny that she decided that out of all the people that she could have went after, she could have went after students, she could have went after legacies. The reason this is kind of near and dear to my heart, my sister is a University of Texas graduate, and I remember what she had to go through to get into the University of Texas. She was in the top 10% of her class.
Right.
She was volunteering. She was the drum major. She did all this stuff, and she got into the University of Texas. This young woman wasn't qualified by any means. It was mediocre grades, and she didn't get in. So I just found this fight to be somewhat hilarious that she would take this all the way to the Supreme Court. So I'm glad it finally came down the way it did.
Mm-hmm.
Even after that, she still ended up going to a good school. She still ended up going to LSU, but she was upset that she didn't get into her quote-unquote dream school, which I just find to be funny. But you also mentioned the sit-in that's going on right now, and there's a hashtag right now out. It is a hashtag Dems Never Set. And so I also find this to be somewhat funny because they it's going out and saying how Dems never set to stop the war in Iraq, to raise minimum wage, mandatory paternity leave. So I understand, I understand what they're sitting for right now, but it is what we like to call weak sauce.
Yes,
it's all for show, but for the issues that have kind of plagued us for the past generations, they never set for the Voting Rights Act.
Right. Well, see, that's where I was about to go. I was about to say, now, if they'd have done a sit-in around the Voting Rights Act when that was gutted, that would have been meaningful.
Exactly. It's so much stuff that they decided, and I understand they have a bit of media fervor behind them right now, so they're doing this. But it's like, I'm like, where y'all been for the past, I'm still in my 30s. I'm like, where y'all been since I was a kid?
Oh, yes.
Y'all haven't sit for a lot of stuff. And then finally, you talked about weapons. I'm a veteran.
Okay.
And I'm not going to go into it too much, but I've used everything from, M16s, grenade launchers. I could get into it. An assault weapon is only created to kill human beings.
Yes.
I know this. Mm. I've seen people even on KBOO as of recently defending these weapons.
Mm.
I've seen what they can do.
Right.
I don't care if you put it on automatic fire, single fire. When a round, and depending on the round, and I won't get into the details, when it hits a human being or if it hits an animal and it tumbles, it's done to do one thing, and that's cause massive amounts of damage. So for anyone that's defending it, oh, it's for sport, it's a sporting rifle. No, it's not. It's meant to kill human beings.
Yes.
So that's all I got to say, and I appreciate your show. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate you calling in. Have a great day.
You too.
503-231-8187 is the number to call. Hello, Mitch. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Joanne.
Hi.
I think you very rightly asked the question, where has the Department of Justice been?
Yes.
The federal authority
that
responded to what has become. And when I say what has become, I'm talking about a span of 15 years.
Yes.
But what has become a coast-to-coast crisis of confidence in law enforcement.
Yes.
And I use the term law enforcement because it's not just city police departments that we have this crisis of confidence in. As you well know, and as our great alternative press and KBOO News have covered, even Multnomah County sheriffs are being forced to resign and are being replaced by people going through the police lobbying revolving doors.
Right.
But I think that your listeners, because I found this very illuminating, should go to the East Bay Express, which is the alternative weekly in Oakland, Berkeley. Go to the East Bay Express website,
okay,
and look up their coverage of what has only in the last week become a national story with the Oakland, three Oakland police chiefs being fired in 9 days.
Right.
But you have to look at that in context, because across the bay in San Francisco, their police chief in May, 1 month ago, was forced out on charges related to institutional racism. And so we have to look at this. What I found in the East Bay Express articles, because they've been covering this for years now, but the most recent few months, if you go to their website and look at their features, you begin to see that the Department of Justice was called into the Oakland Police Department, just like they were called into Portland a few years ago.
Right.
But in Oakland, they were called in, Joanne, 13 years ago.
Yes. Right. Well, we have to acknowledge that it is the DOJ that's created the police departments that now they claim they're reforming.
Right.
Right.
And I mean, the Oakland mayor was saying, she, after having to remove the third in 9 days, was saying, you know, I'm trying to run a police department, not a frat house.
Right. Ooh.
But we're
right.
talking 13 years of federal emergency supervision of an out-of-control law enforcement agency, and instead of getting better, it has escalated to what I really don't think political satirists could have even dreamt up, because it wouldn't be considered realistic humor.
No, I so agree with you, and I think that's exactly, we have the same problem here. The former police chief, Mike Reese, who was found to consistently lie to his bosses about budgets and what they're voting on at the city council. I mean, he just lied through his teeth. Now is the undersheriff at Multnomah County waiting to take over the sheriff position when Dan Stanton waits until his PERS increases so that he can retire in August. And this seems to be normal in policing agencies, to take bad cops from one agency to the next, to the next, to the next. And when you have bad cops in leadership, there's no hope of reform throughout the organization.
Yes, and I'm very suspicious that this has anything to do with partisan politics at the national level, because 13 years of DOJ supervision of Oakland PD, and these are the outcomes, tells us that it extends beyond the Obama administration back in to the Bush administration.
Yes.
And the DOJ was staffed under the Clinton administration, because we saw that when Obama took power, instead of purging the State Department like the Bush administration did the minute they got in, and they put their chicken hawks in to increase military spending at the State Department, Obama got elected on a platform of opposing Hillary Clinton's foreign policy. That's how he beat her in the very competitive primaries of 2008. And then he turns around and names her as head of the State Department looks on as she carries over the entire Bush-Cheney team at the State Department.
Yes.
And they begin regime changing the first year, 2009, of the new reform administration that people like us worked at the grassroots level to institute. I mean, this is so clearly a government bipartisan that is out of control.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree with that. So we had a lot of work to do. I mean, I wish that Congress was now sitting in to make sure that every single American had the opportunity to fully participate in the upcoming election season. That would be phenomenal.
Could you, on your show today on the KBOO website, which is such a useful resource, on your webpage for this show, which will have the audio archive of this discussion, could you post a link to the East Bay Express articles that show us the history?
Yes, I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you.
I will do that later today.
And keep doing what you're doing, because you saw this years ago.
I've been working on this through 5 police commissioners, 7 police chiefs, and we're worse off today than we were when I just first started working on. It's been a while. But thank you very much for your kind words.
And we're lucky to have you here in Portland.
Well, thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too.
503-231-8187 is the number to call. I realize that I'm old because I've been doing this for a long, long time. It's not until I start counting the years that I realize that I'm old, but that's okay. I'll get over that. Sad news, and not surprising news, that the Baltimore officer was found not guilty in the Freddie Gray murder case. Cesar Goodson, a Baltimore police officer accused of giving a rough ride in a van that killed Freddie Gray, was found not guilty today of the most serious charge he faced, second-degree murder. No surprise that police officers are not held accountable for how they interact and engage with community members, especially if they happen to be Black or low-income, homeless, without power in the community. And I think that latest Supreme Court ruling will only exacerbate what's already a very, very troubling challenge in our local community as well as on the national level. It's not just a Portland problem, but certainly Portland is not better than any other police department because we've got big, big problems right here. And so, if you want to join the conversation, give me a call at 503-231-8187. And as always, I've been kind of all over the board today. I started off talking about the Supreme Court decision on Monday having to do with illegal police stops and how the U.S. Supreme Court has decided by a 5-3 vote that it's perfectly fine to prosecute people if the police had no reason to stop them, if they were not doing anything illegal, there was no reason for the stop, but the police happens to stop you and the police happen to search you, if they happen to find something, then the police are within their right to take you to jail and the district attorney is within their right to prosecute you. I'm not surprised anymore by any rulings that come out of the U.S. Supreme Court. But I have to tell you, what an incredible difference 30 years of Supreme Court decisions make. Because 30 years ago, that was not the U.S. Supreme Court. What we have today, they talk about activist judges. That's exactly what we have chairing the U.S. Supreme Court. So I'm going to go back to the phone line. Good morning, Sunny. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning, Joanne.
How are you today?
Oh, well, I'm all right. And, you know, I have to ask you a fast question. That Supreme Court candidate that Obama put up?
Yes.
Okay. I looked away for a while, and now it looks like the process is stopped, or what happened?
I thought. Oh, yeah. It never went any. I mean, the Republican Congress just said, nope, not going to vote on it.
They were just allowed to say, uh-uh.
Yep.
So they can still pull the No. Oh, and you know, he looked completely acceptable, but beyond that, of course, they have a duty to fulfill.
Right.
Okay. Then the other thing.
Well, and let's just say, let's be honest. I mean, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court does not need another white man. So, I mean, the fact that Obama, that was his choice when he had so many other options, was disappointing. And so, you know, so I'm torn. I don't know. The fact that Congress hasn't voted on him, I don't know whether that's a good or bad thing. But I was disappointed that with the Browning of America, that his nominee would be a white guy.
Mm-hmm.
Just have to say that.
I would imagine, though, that the chances for that
for anything else,
person of color appointment is probably even more dim.
But it would have been much more courageous to have appointed the person you wanted to appoint, to nominate, right, than to nominate someone that you think could possibly squeak through this particular Congress. Because it shouldn't be about this Congress. It should be about that person will have a lifetime position on the court. And as we see, that matters.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, it really does. Thanks for Sotomayor, my goodness. What she brought up there was really important. The thing with Freddie Gray is he had no record whatsoever, and prior to being picked up, he was running because he was already terrorized by the police.
Right.
And when they picked him up, he was screaming at the top of his voice, "I can't even watch it. It breaks my heart when I see that mm-hmm. footage." And, of course, they cut the sound off.
Of course.
On the story. He was screaming, "They are going to kill me." And in all of the stories that come across the news, they never bother to put that in. That they're going, you know, this fellow was pointing out that these people were on him already. And, you know, we just can't do that. We can't do that for people of color. We can't let them come up alongside us. We can't let them have an even chance in the race because, you know, just can't do it. And it's really sad. And it just shows the kind of strength that the people in this country who are being treated in this terrible way, the kind of strength and character, fortitude, beauty,
resilience.
Yeah, we have.
Yes.
We got it.
Yes, yes. That is absolutely true. Mm-hmm. I mean, and you think about the history, you know, oh my gosh. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We've, you know, people, both of our peoples should have been gone a long time ago.
mm-hmm.
But here we are still.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're going to keep going, and we have lots of good things for everybody. And we're going to keep trying.
Well, you know, Sunny, you were named very appropriately because every time you call, you put a sunshine on my face. So,
aww.
Thank you.
Oh, well. I feel the same way, dear. I do.
Mutual love. Have a great day.
Yes, you too.
Thank you.
Bye.
503-231-8187 is the number to call. We're going to go back to the phone line. Okay, no worry. We will go back to the phone line when you call 503-231-8187. And so, yes, we are, I don't want people to feel like there's nothing we can do when we think about police oversight. Like I mentioned earlier, I think it's a really good idea to contact the city council and just kind of ask them, what are they doing to, what's the process for an interim police chief, right? Where are they going to find someone from? Are they going to bring someone from retirement? Are they going to, hey, that's a good idea. How about bringing someone in from retirement who never shot their gun the entire time that they served on the Portland Police Bureau and making them the interim chief? How about bringing someone in that actually could be, that could help move reform forward during this transition between the current mayor and the new mayor? New mayor takes office January 1st. There's a lot of time between now and then, and a lot of progress could be made around police reform if we had the right interim police chief. And so that decision, I hope, is a decision that's in the works. And if you know good candidates, I think the city council would be really appreciative of hearing about who you think could be the interim chief. And, you know, they would probably be there for about, you know, 9 to 12 months because knowing that the new police commissioner comes in on January 1st, figuring it takes a while to do a national recruitment, it would be great if he started now. I don't know if legally he can do that, but those are the kind of ideas that we should be considering as we're preparing for the next administration. Because I do believe that this administration is kind of just imploded. And so we're just waiting to see what the next steps are. And actually not waiting, hopefully putting pressure on the policymakers to do their job here and actually get an interim police chief named because the other ones, are until they're done with the investigation, and what we know about IPR is it takes them a long, long, long time to investigate police officers. In fact, we are still waiting for the officers involved in the Ty Grew case, Remember that case almost 3 years ago now, that the Roosevelt student was aggressively arrested and charged with attempted murder of police officers until the judge saw the community videotape. And the judge determined that the police officer's testimony was not credible. And supposedly, IAD, the Internal Affairs Division, and IPR, the Independent Police Review, both immediately took up an investigation of that incident and those police officers. And unfortunately, those police officers are still walking the street in North Portland because nothing has happened. And so I don't have a lot of confidence that the IPR would actually conduct a timely investigation because their record is horribly bad for actually being able to investigate police officers in a timely manner. And so I always use Tigru as my Exhibit A, because we're still waiting to hear back from that. And every time I've talked to the Department of Justice, every time Portland Cop Watch talks to the Department of Justice, every time the AMA Coalition for Justice and Police Reform talks to the Department of Justice, we ask them about the Tigru case. And every time they say they're still working on it. Well, the DOJ investigation required investigations be conducted within a set period of time, 6 months, 180 days. So far, there's been no repercussions for the police bureau to continue to miss that deadline. No repercussions at all for missing that deadline. No repercussions for not actually doing a thorough investigation and letting the public know what the findings are. In a case like that, where this kid could have had the potential to spend the next 30 years of a mandatory minimum sentence in jail, you would think that there would be more urgency around both the Internal Affairs Division investigation as well as the Independent Police Review, which, as you know, isn't independent, doesn't really review the cops. They actually review the notes of the cops who investigated the cops. Totally unworthy of community support to have a so-called accountability system that throws out 74% of the complaints they get in every year. So we have a lot of work to do in this community around police accountability. I think the good news is that more people are paying attention, that we have a structural system failure that must be addressed, and must be addressed in a methodical, thoughtful, detailed way. And if not, what we end up with is what we have now: dysfunctional systems across the board. And quite frankly, many of the oversight advisory boards that were put in place by former Chief Mike Reese were only put in place as gatekeepers to keep the public from having access to good information about what was taking place. And so we have systems failures that can be fixed, but we need the political will to actually fix those systems, because, quite frankly, we have not seen the political will to fundamentally fix what's broken. I think that there's a lot of circling the wagon, but not a lot of real changes, fundamental changes to how the Portland Police Bureau operates. I really miss Chief O'Day, because I really believe that he at least was pushing to move reform forward with a plan that was clear. But without his leadership and without the rest of the assistant chiefs being able to assume that leadership, the leadership void around moving a racially equitable policy through the Portland Police Bureau appears to be dead on arrival. I hope that that's not true. I hope that the community demands better. I hope that the city council actually steps into their role, which is to monitor the settlement agreement that they signed off on, to monitor whether or not, to actually evaluate whether or not they're getting their money's worth for hiring a Chicago consultant to provide oversight of the police reform. We're 2 years, 2.5 years into this Chicago consultant. Is it time to actually cut our losses and, I don't know, hire somebody locally that knows about police accountability? Just a thought. This is the time to be having that conversation. While we're going through this leadership transition, we need to have good minds coming together to figure out how do we make sure that we don't squander the millions of dollars we've already spent on pretend police reform and the millions of hours that volunteer community members have put in to actually try to move a reform agenda, and not to mention the equity office of the police bureau. I mean, we've had slow movement over the last couple of years, but we've had movement. Now it appears that we're moving backwards. But if we had leadership from the Portland City Council, if we had a appointment that would actually move a reform agenda forward, if the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division would actually step into their leadership role and actually demand accountability from both the police commissioner and the police bureau, we'd be a whole lot further along. The fact that they still have not approved more than one recommendation. I don't even think they've approved one yet of all the work that the Community Oversight Advisory Board has done. They have made well over 70 some recommendations to the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division, to which they have accepted zero so far. And so if I was on that Community Oversight Advisory Board, I'd be wondering the same thing. Why am I doing all this work if then it gets stuck at the DOJ and the DOJ hasn't actually developed the protocol yet to determine how they're going to process those recommendations? You would think with all the settlements agreements they've done all across the country that would already be a template in place. So stay tuned. I wish I had more optimistic news for you today about where we are in Portland around police accountability. I wish I had better news of where we are as far as the Supreme Court upholding our right to be left alone against excessive policing. Clearly, the U.S. Supreme Court doesn't believe that we have a right to be left alone. I think that this is going to make policing less safe, not just for the community, but also for police officers, because many, many, many communities, when pushed, will push back. This is not good for police reform, not good for the communities who will have to live under it, and hopefully not good for public policy, because we need to make sure that public policy, that would be a good legislative agenda item. We need to make sure that public policy actually upholds the constitutional right to be left the heck alone. I think that needs to be a legislative agenda item on somebody's agenda next legislative session, because the only way to counter the U.S. Supreme Court is to pass local laws to assure that, no, we actually believe the U.S. Constitution means something different. And so that should be a lovely legislative conversation next year. We've got work to do. We got a lot of people who want to be reelected, only who knows why. And so hopefully you'll be asking them about that. We will have a new president coming in January. Heaven help us with that, because, you know, it's going to be bad. It's just whether it's going to be really, really, really bad or whether it's just going to be bad. Someone accused me of being cynical yesterday, and I was absolutely surprised to hear me be referred to as cynical. But I guess today, if I listen back on this broadcast, there might be a little cynicism creeping into my worldview, but just a little. My response to being told that I was cynical was that I'm just paying attention. I'm just reading the data. I'm just analyzing the information that comes in front of me. If that makes me I said, it doesn't make me cynical, because if I was cynical, that information would just paralyze me and make me immobile and I wouldn't do anything. But as you know, I do a lot more than just nothing. I do a lot of stuff. And so I was like a bit surprised to be called cynical, because I don't believe I am. If I was cynical, I would say, nothing you do matters. It's just all doom and gloom, right? It's just it's a bad, bad place. But it's not, you and I can make a difference. We have to try each and every day. I will see you next week. Same time, same place, same station. Thank you very much, Steve, as always. Have a great, 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 great day.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth.
And good morning. It is KBOO Portland Community Radio for Portland, Oregon. Coming up in an hour, we've got Air Cascadia with Chris Andre for your Thursday. Then at 10:15, join us for Flashpoints, a report from the tense situation in Oaxaca, the Election Crimes Bulletin with Greg Pallast, and legal scholar Marjorie Cohn on proposed U.S. airstrikes on Syrian troops. At 11 today on Between the Covers, host Bethany Grabo talks with Laura O. Foster, author of the new book Walking with Ramona, exploring Beverly Cleary's Portland. And at 11:30 on The Film Show, Ibrahim Mubarak talks about the upcoming documentary screening of Right to Survive, Breaking the Chains. And comedy writer and author Steve Young explains exactly what an industrial musical is. That is all coming up this morning. But first, we've got Teresa Mitchell hosting Press Watch with the news you're not supposed to know. Stick around. That's next on KBOO.
KBOO is getting ready for our annual book and record sale. Yay! This is a great time to clean out those closets and shelves and turn your old books, records, and CDs into cash for community radio. Bring them to KBOO Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. We're accepting donations of books, vinyl records, CDs, and DVDs through Wednesday, August 10th. The sale will be held in mid-August. Stay tuned for details. Please, no home recorded cassettes, VHS tapes, or mold. If you have questions or want to arrange for a pickup of donations, please email Ani at volunteer@kboo.org or phone her at 503-231-8032, extension 213.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant